Hello, I'm Sam Clements. Welcome to this special episode of the Picture House podcast. Special because we are joined by two of the filmmakers involved with Incredibles 2, producers John Walker and Nicole Paradis-Grindle, both of whom worked with Brad Bird on his much-anticipated and long-awaited sequel to 2004's The Incredibles. Incredibles 2 opened in UK cinemas right now. They were both in town just after the film opened in the US, where it broke box office records as the highest grossing animated film of all time. It had beat Finding Dory, which previously held that record. No idea what held it before Finding Dory. So they were in very good, they're in a very good mood, very high spirits. And I think this film was a tricky one. Its release date was brought forward by a year, but they worked hard and they meet their release date. And fascinating, in the podcast, we talk about some of the challenges they faced whilst doing that. I think it took a while to crack the story, as they say. Nicole is a long-serving member of Pixar staff. She's worked there for over 20 years. She's been an animator, supervising effects teams. She has been a producer, a production manager, and she's worked in a variety of projects from tie-in video games to movies. She worked on Toy Story 3, worked on Monsters University, and yeah, has been there for a really long time and just knows the team. She actually worked as a more of a crew member on the first Incredibles film, and now she's back producing The Incredibles 2. John is a long-term Brad Bird collaborator. John Walker is Brad Bird's regular producer. He has been working with him all the way back to Iron Giant, which I believe is Brad Bird's first feature film, which I love The Iron Giant so much. And he's worked with Brad Bird on every single one of his films since then. So it's someone who knows Brad really well, someone who knows Pixar really well. And it was a real joy to talk to him on the podcast. I do find, generally speaking, not that I've spoken to a bunch of producers for this podcast, but I do find that the Pixar producers are so involved in the process. They offer some really fascinating insights. And if you look through our pod feed, you'll definitely see one we did for Coco and one we did for Finding Dory last year. Go back and if you like Pixar, listen to the Finding Dory and Coco podcast. They were really nice people to talk to, and again, fascinating. But anyway, those films are old. We're excited about Incredibles 2. It's in cinemas now. I loved the film. I had such a great time. It does everything a sequel needs to do, and it was so nice to be back with the Parr family. There's also a lovely short film, as Pixar tend to do, ahead of Incredibles 2. So if you are going to see Incredibles 2 in the cinema, make sure you get there early so you can catch the short place directly before it. Anyway, without further ado, I will pass over to myself, John, and Nicole, and we'll have a good old chat about Incredibles 2. It's a really great film to see on a big screen. Amazing soundtrack by Michael Giacchino, who did the first film, which is just a joy to hear. Enjoy the podcast, enjoy the film. Goodbye.
John, Nicole, it's really great to talk to you on the podcast today. We're really excited to open Incredibles 2, as we are whenever there's a new Pixar film. And we're so spoiled because in the UK we only had Coco in January. So not very long after have we had to wait.
No, not at all.
You've just had this fantastic opening in the US. But how did you feel this time last week?
Oh, gosh.
We felt nervous. You never know how these things are going to go. We liked the film, but I've liked other films and worked very hard on them, and they went out there and didn't do what we expected them or hoped that they would do. So you never know. The only thing about the movie business is nobody knows anything, and that's the truth.
That's true.
Yeah, and so we were nervous.
The larger Pixar community, those who had not worked on the film, liked it, and they're pretty tough critics. Sometimes I almost think they're our toughest audience. And when they said they liked it, and they never pull their punches, they always tell us the truth. No. I thought, well, this bodes well. But you're right, we never really know, but that was a good sign.
Pixar's got that legendary sort of internal screening process. Yes. And you get a lot of feedback.
Yeah, it's a little brutal, some of that feedback. One of the things we talked about at the wrap party was to take all the mean notes we got, and some of them were awful, and do like a mean tweets thing, and we just read them at the wrap party and go,
shame them all.
See you guys, it worked out.
We'll do that tomorrow.
We'll do that tomorrow. Yeah.
So that's a good thing to have up your sleeve. Yeah. I think a lot of people have been looking forward to a sequel to Incredibles. It's definitely one of my favorite films, and also one of those films which I just resigned myself to the fact it won't get a sequel.
We kind of did too.
Yeah, nothing's ever guaranteed in life.
Do you remember at the point where Incredibles 2 was a reality? How many years ago was that?
Well, it was probably a little over three. I mean, maybe it was December of 2014 was the first time we sat down together.
Yeah. We were working on Tomorrowland, and he started talking seriously about it for the first time. because mm-hmm. we'd been talking about it on and off for years. Mm-hmm. And he maybe 7 or 8 years ago, sat down with Ted Mathout, our head of story, and they boarded up the first sequence for The Underminer. Mm-hmm. It's different, but because he always wanted to start it right away. But then that went away, and he did Mission, and then we did Tomorrowland, and it was like, mm-hmm. and then he started to be serious about it. I think it was because Sam Jackson gave him such a hard time, and he didn't want to cross him anymore. You know, it's like Sam was getting kind of mean about it, and it was like, maybe you better make it.
Yeah. You don't want him on your bad side.
Yeah. It's beyond a joke now. We need to make this for Sam.
Yeah.
Well, I'm very grateful for Sam. Yeah. I mean, over those sort of 10 years before you started to talk about this seriously, there's a lot of fans. This film's connected with a lot of people. Is that quite a heavy sort of thing to have on your shoulders when planning a sequel to something as beloved as The Incredibles?
You know, every film at Pixar feels that way. I mean, you don't want to be the film that ends the streak. Mm. But at the same time, we also try to isolate ourselves from the outside world a little bit. Yeah. If we didn't, I think we would just curl up into the fetal position and never get up again. So, you know, we put our heads down and we start making the film and try not to think too much about that.
Right. Well, you can get distracted easily by just all the problems you have making it. Mm. You don't have enough bandwidth to worry about the outside world too much. It's just too hard to make the bliss out of this. You know, it's like this, just making any movie. I mean, you have these compounding miracles that you have to actually make it. That's the first miracle. Then you have to get it distributed, the second miracle, and then people have to like it, the third, right? And if you can get all three of those things to happen, it's like, you know, amen. So we love, you know, I love anybody that makes any movie. I am, you know, I'm in awe of.
Was there a particular starting point with this film when it came to story and talking to Brad about the script?
Well, he had the original idea that Helen would be the one to get the assignment, I understand, 14 years ago when mm-hmm. he and John were promoting the first movie. So he had that and also what he calls the unexploded bomb of Jack-Jack. Jack-Jack's powers, because as you may recall, the family was not aware of Jack-Jack's mm-hmm. powers. Syndrome encountered them and Kari, the babysitter, did, but the family hadn't seen them. So he knew he had those two ingredients, and it sounds like he had the Underminer scene kind of.
He had that, and we also had the raccoon fight, because we knew that was an idea for the first film, and we just couldn't fit in, and we always loved it. And Teddy Newton, who was a story artist and designer on the first film, came up with that idea, and he had these just hilarious boards, and it was much darker sequence for Teddy. He had like a gang of raccoons, right? And they tried to drown Jack-Jack in the pool, and it was a little dark, but it was a great, I mean, it was just like, oh, Teddy, where'd you fight a baby fighting a raccoon? So that's we knew that was going to be in the film, and it was the first sequence that we made, and we kept just going back to it and going, see, when the whole movie was falling apart, because, well, we got the baby fighting a raccoon. That's worth $10, don't you think?
Could be, absolutely. I think we could sell that.
Yeah, that's right.
How did the story change as you were involved?
Oh, well, the villain plot changed dramatically. The original pitch involved a completely different villain. Then there was another one, a second one, that didn't work out, and it was relatively recently that the final villain landed. In the end, crafting the story arc for the family, it was the first step. Mm. Of course, that wasn't evident to us initially, but while everything was in motion, it was alarming. And then finally it was clear, well, if we could just figure out what happens with Bob and the kids, then we can figure out where Helen and the villain fit into that. And in the end, we needed a villain plot that supported her leaving the family. It didn't make sense for her to abandon her family unless there was something really compelling. So once it became clear that she was leaving in order to help make Supers legal again, mm-hmm. and that was in order to allow her children to grow up and be legal, that was more compelling. And so you needed a villain that served that.
It's a really fantastic driving force through the film. And even though the family are separated for a lot of the film, because it's bringing the family closer, because she's doing it for such good reasons.
Yeah. Yes, yes.
We found a couple of things, little touchstones that we wrote on the board all the time. Mm-hmm. One was, parenting is a heroic act. Mm-hmm. And do you change the world to fit your kids, or do you change your kids to fit the world? And those two ideas, and then the third was all in all Incredibles movies, you never do something mundane very long without doing something fantastic, and don't do something fantastic very long without doing something mundane. And if we could, pinging around between those three things is where we've stumbled our way through into the finished film.
Feels like some really good guidelines, for life as well.
Brad's just so great at that. You know, he had that great thing for Ratatouille. I didn't work on it, but it was, he was trying to, that something to focus it. And it was, rats are takers, cooks are givers. You know, it's like, that's great. You know, if you get these little haikus.
Right. An essential idea.
What are we doing here again?
Because it's hard. You get lost in the make-believe of it all. And it's like, well, why are we here? Where are we trying to get? And if you have that one thematic element, and it didn't come right away.
No, you discover that stuff. And you can talk about it in reverse. But it sounds like, they figured this all out. Then they went through and it's all very...
It's nothing like that.
It's just chaos every day. and what was it again? Something about parenting?
It sounds like it's amazing, though, to, when you're in that sort of, the flurry of making the film, to actually notice, like, actually, guys, we're going slightly off course.
Absolutely. That happens all the time. Yeah. We're constantly sailing off course and then having to come back to, well, what story are we telling here? Whose story? Well, remember, we have to figure out this Bob story.
This
what's happening with Helen?
And this is really funny, but I love it, but I won't work. Kill it.
Total distraction. That's for another movie.
Yeah, you come up with this. I mean, Brad must have written, at least another 90 pages of stuff that we just. And the scenes themselves are great. Yeah. They're funny. They're cool. Yeah. They're, and it was like.
There'll be a few of them on the Blu-ray. But if they don't serve that main theme, then you have to kill them.
Yeah, there's no point in it being great for no reason. Such a core theme, and you've only got a finite amount of time to tell it,
That's right. That's right.
I'm sure some people would love the 4-hour cut.
Some people would. Brad, I'm sure.
This and the first film, sort of admire is how it gives every character a moment and a complete arc. And that's so hard to do, and it's so rare, I think, which is why it's quite a satisfying watch as an audience. I just can't even imagine sort of how do you plot everybody's story
I mean, for a long time, we were like, oh my gosh, we've left Dash out.
That's right. Right?
It's like, oh.
Well, folks complained.
Yeah, he disappeared, right?
Well, I missed like, Dash. Where's
where is he? And we're going, oh yeah, you're right. We got to get Dash more. That's how it happens. It's like we work on it. We just keep putting up these imperfect versions of it, and we hope that we have enough input and enough inspiration, and that by the time they take it away from us, that it's passable, and we're still going, it's not ready.
We're really lucky in the studio. There's so many smart, talented directors and story people. And so when we show it to them, they have really meaningful feedback, and we'll also sit and discuss it with them. So we are working out what's missing, because they also can't give us these neat and tidy notes and tell us exactly how you should fix it.
Something's wrong here. And
if you work it out together, sit in the room for several hours, brainstorming it. We had a smaller group of advisors who sat with us, and it starts to emerge over time, weeks and weeks and weeks of hacking away.
So how did you feel when you got the right iteration of the villain and it clicked? That must have been quite
it's funny because it's hard to identify exactly when, but I do remember, we had struggled so much with the end of the movie, the third act of the film. Yeah. And we were pressuring Brad to write it, and he was like, I'm working on this other stuff. And we go, we got to get this thing into production. You got to do it. I don't have enough time. And the story team had done multiple iterations of it, and they finally got some info from Brad, and they put some stuff together, and they pitched it, and we went, that'll work. It's not right yet, but that'll work. And from there was a point where we said, okay, we can make that, and it'll be
entertaining.
It'll be good.
And
it'll
compelling,
be good.
Yeah. And it'll bring closure to the story that we've been telling.
And believe me, that was a long time coming, and a big part of our job was, we've got 400 people working on this thing, and they're looking at these reels we're putting up with their arms crossed, going,
whoa, where's the brilliance of Brad Bird? And, you know, we've heard a lot about his filmmaking, and we don't think that's quite up to snuff. And we're like, hang on, we're not done yet.
You know? We're just going to keep running until we run out of time.
We'll get there.
The joy, I guess, of doing a sequel is you get to build the universe out, and there's a whole bunch of new characters. What's your, like, personal favorite characters? And is there one which was maybe a bit more of a challenge to bring to the screen and to get right?
Well, I love the new superhero Void, voiced by Sophia Bush, and her superpower is actually technically fairly challenging. I didn't even think about it, but you know, our technical supervisor pointed out how difficult it was. There was one shot in particular where you're looking through her void hole into another one, and another one sort of goes through this infinite thing. You know, it's like holding up, you know, mirrors against mirrors. So that was technically very challenging and kind of conceptually challenging. But she's also my favorite. I love the performance. I love how much she admires Helen. Mm. And I think it's a super cool power that really pays off at the end, not to give anything away, but...
So it was really spectacular just seeing the logic of the passing.
They've tried to explain it to me multiple times, and I still don't get it. I've got other things to worry about.
It's cool, and it also has moments where it's really funny.
I'm completely baffled by it. You know, it's like, I go, what do you guys...
Thanks so much for talking to us today, and... thank you for this film. We can't wait to play it in our theatres.
No, I'm so glad. Can't wait for you to play it.
Cheers. Thank you.
Enjoy.
Listening to the Picture House podcast, a Picture House's production brought to you by Picture House Cinemas. We would like to thank everyone who works at Picture House Cinemas and everyone who has ever attended a screening of a film at a Picture House cinema. Thanks for listening, and see you next week.